Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
All right, ready for another installment of It's My House. And today our guest is Kermit Washington. So for people that have followed the NBA, National Basketball Association, over the years, are familiar with his name, but he's done more than that on a positive note with feeding people and Africa. So we'll be back with Mr. Washington in about 2 minutes.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right, we got our morning motivation, and we're about to get some more motivation here from Kermit Washington. Good morning, Kermit.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, fine. Kermit, I'm going to go back in the Wayback Machine to start off this interview, and thanks for coming on because I know you're in a different time zone here. I'm originally from D.C. You're originally from D.C. Now, I'm going way back here. I grew up in the – primarily grew up in the 211 zip code in D.C. and had I gone to a public high school in D.C., it would have been Coolidge, and that's the high school you went to. So what zip code were you in up growing up in D.C.?
Now, say that again. What was I
– I was in the 211 zip code. I was in the 211 zip code living in D.C.
Yeah.
And had I gone to public school, high school in D.C., it would have been the Coolidge. But I went to the math instead. I didn't go to the public school route in D.C. So I was just asking you, did you live in that same zip code?
Well, I did, but I was supposed to go to Roosevelt. But at the time, I didn't want to go to Roosevelt because there was a lot of gang activity at that time. And I'm talking about 1966 to 1969. So there was the Decatur Street Gang in that at that time, and I had gone to Bertie Bacchus. You ever hear of Bertie Bacchus, junior high school?
Man, I got a house to the childhood house to this day directly behind Bertie Bacchus on 7th Street.
Okay, Bertie Bacchus at that time had people going to that school that were part of the Decatur Street Gang and then the Riggs Park Gang. And after Bertie Bacchus, I said, I don't want to be involved in any of this anymore. So Friday, my homeroom teacher says, go to the map and tell me what high school region you're in. Now, I was in Roosevelt, but she was too lazy to get up and check. So I said, Coolidge. I said, Coolidge. I want to go to Coolidge. I'm in Coolidge zone. So I was able to go to Coolidge. And a lot of other people did the same thing, too. At the time, Roosevelt was a good school, good sports school, but I just didn't want to be walking through the Decatur Street gang area anymore. So Coolidge, that's why I went to Coolidge High School.
All right. Well, now Bertie Beck is on a basketball level. James Brown, the sports care. I don't follow sports like I used to. I don't know if he's still on CBS football anymore, but James Brown, the math in Harvard.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was my he was my classmate in Bertie Bacchus.
Oh, okay. Well, James Brown, and then of course Adrian Dantley went there as well.
Yeah. Well, James Brown went to school with. We went to school together, but he left, I think, the eighth grade to go to DeMatha. He was with me in the seventh grade.
All right. Okay. Well, my house was, we moved there probably 2 years prior to Kennedy getting assassinated. So, yeah, I never, matter of fact, I'd only been in Backers one time. And that was to play some basketball game during some summer tryout thing. But, you know, I never went to school there and whatnot. Now,
well,
let's go over.
How old are you? How old are you now? What is your
65 right now. 65.
Okay.
I graduated.
I'm
76. Hey, I graduated 76 from high school.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, I graduated high school 1969. So, you know, the thing is, James Brown, he had a lot of great athletes out of D.C. But he went on to DeMatha. And I try to explain to people, well, DeMatha was a really good basketball school because they could go to Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. and get the very best players, whereas the public schools, you had to live in the area to go and play basketball there. So DeMatha was very fortunate to be able to go around and handpick the very best players in the city and have them go to the school. So that's why DeMatha was good for many, many years. Are they still good at all?
When I graduated college in 1980. So since then, I went to West Texas. Well, it was then called West Texas State University. Now it's West Texas A&M University. Maurice Cheeks was my teammate on that squad for 2 years. He was two years ahead of me. But since 1980, when I graduated, man, I really don't. Other than watching some highlights, I couldn't tell you who started, I mean, what college teams or what. And if it's not basketball, like entrepreneurial related, you know, like who makes tennis shoes, I mean, if the manufacturer or something like that, or what you do, feeding people in Africa, I really, you know, I don't really follow sports that much anymore. So,
for me and my brother, he played pro football with the St. Louis Cardinals. Well, for us, that was the only way we were going to go to college. I mean, back then, nobody had any money. Well, none of the black people I was around had any money to be able to go to college anywhere. And the Vietnam War was at its highest peak right at that time, and they were just taking people off to Vietnam, and a lot of them didn't come back. And so I just was glad to go to college because that's when they had the draft. And if your number came up, you were going to Vietnam.
Now, see, when I was coming through, they just ended that. ended that. So, let's go. All right, now, one part of your – now, I didn't see you play in your early years, but the a story that I used to hear Morgan Wooten tell – every now and then is, and I forgot what it could have been to one of them all-star teams tournaments to Aberdeen or something like that. Morgan Wooten would say Joe Gallagher would cut you, and Joe Gallagher would say Morgan Wooten cut you. But what I want to go back in is your high school days. What grade did you start playing? And then, because you didn't start right away.
Listen, I didn't even go out for the team until my senior year in high school. So I played football and, you know, I went on bats and baseball and played tennis. Anything that got me out of classes, I took back then. And the reason I started playing basketball was my best friend, one of my best friend, Glenn Price, had a car. And he says, if you go out for the basketball team, I'll give you a ride to school and a ride home. I said, that's the best deal I've ever heard. I said, I'll go out for the team. So I wasn't expecting to play at all. I was expecting just to make the team and, you know, just have a front row seat to watch the games. That's about it.
Right.
I didn't expect to play, but a couple of guys hadn't done
that was in 11th grade?
No, my 12th grade. I didn't play till my 12th grade
year. 12th grade year, okay.
And,
so you
played
basketball until 12th grade?
I played on the playground, but I wasn't very good. But and then all of a sudden,
okay.
I said, no, I, well, in my 12th grade
so you
year.
Went out for, your first time playing organized ball was 12th grade?
12th grade, yes.
Man,
I
that's amazing.
Not only that, but I didn't even get in a lot of the games my senior year. I mean, I averaged maybe, I'd say 5 points and maybe 2 rebounds. That's about it. And because I was a pretty good football player, and I was embarrassed of my performances. And right after the season ended, I said, well, let me start practicing so at least I can be better on the playground. I didn't think about going to college or anything else like that. But as you said about James Brown, he was one of the best players in the city. McKinley Tech, I thought, had the best team. The Mather was very good. Mackin was good. I don't know if there's a Mackin anymore. And you had a couple of other teams that were pretty
good. Corbin and Carroll.
Okay. Okay. And so what happened is that he said that he had jumped rope. So what I did, I tell everybody the story. This is exactly a true story. I said, I just wanted to improve to be able to play decently on the playground. So I read that he jumped rope, and then I read another article that Spencer Haywood had a weight vest, a 20-pound weight vest. So I said, let me just go buy a weight vest, and I started jumping rope, and I got up to jumping rope 10,000 times every night with a 20-pound weight vest. And I improved so fast in my athletic ability, not really basketball ability, but athletic ability so fast that I could jump. I could jump out the gym. I wasn't skilled as an outside shooter. I wasn't skilled as a dribbler because I really had never really played. But I could play. I could jump, block shots, dunk the ball. And so I got so good so fast. Well, people started saying, well, why don't you try out for that all-star team, which was an Allentown tryout team. And that's where you had all Metropolitan players. They had to let every senior try out. And this is like 2 months after the basketball season's over. They had to let, if you were a senior and you played varsity ball, they had to let you try out. So I had a neighbor, I knew nothing about it, but I had a really honestly a nasty neighbor who got mad because he always saw me out there jumping rope. He says, well, you think you're so good now, why don't you try out for that Allentown tournament team? I said, okay, I'll try out. So I went up there. I hitchhiked the ride. If nobody had picked me up, I would never be talking to you right now. But somebody gave me a ride up to St. John's. I lived over there, you know, where New Hampshire and 2nd Street meet. You know, right there. It's like a little grand
I know exactly where that is.
Okay, that's where I live. So, well, and you know, St. John's is off of, is it Missouri Avenue, Military Road?
That's up on Rock Creek Park, man. You got to go out Military Road. I used to go there every day in the summertime.
Okay, and so that's where I had to get a ride to. And some guy picked me up and gave me a ride half the way, and then somebody else picked me up. So I tried out for the team. And Morgan Wooten, and first of all, is Morgan Wooten still alive? Is he still alive?
No, Morgan passed away, man, within the last 3 or 4 years.
Okay, well, he looks at me. He said, did you play in varsity? I said, I played for Coolidge. He said, well, we played Coolidge, and I don't remember you. So I said, I was sick that day. I was sick that day or something I said like that. And so what happened, it is funny. It is funny. So I tried out, and I played okay. I didn't make the team. But I tried out, and I was impressive to a lot of coaches. They said, well, you don't have a lot of basketball skills, but you really hustle and you work really, really hard and you have potential maybe because I was only 6'4 and a half then. And so Maryland University looked at me and they said, oh, you know, we'd like to maybe offer you a scholarship because back then there were freshman teams and sometimes they just wanted to fill up the freshman team. Then Howard University, George Washington, Rutgers, a lot of coaches like that, you know, said, well, we'll give you an opportunity. And I said, my goodness, I mean, because I wasn't going to college because I didn't have any money. My family didn't have any money to go to college. So in American University, which I had never heard of American University, and came to me, and they said, well, you know, we'll take you out to dinner. I said, okay. And I had never been out to dinner in my life, and I was 17 years old. So they took me out to dinner, and they said, what do you want to eat? I said, well, you know, I looked at the menu. I said, steak looks good. I've never had a steak like that. I had never had a steak. And they brought me a steak. When they brought me a steak at the restaurant, this is funny, it was a big steak. So I thought they were going to cut it up for everybody at the table. It were three coaches at the table. So I said, well, they're going to cut it up four ways. And they said, no, this is yours. I said, this whole steak is mine and everything else that came with it. I said, listen, I'll come to your school. If you're going to feed me like this, I said, I'll come to your school. And I had never been to American University. I had never heard of American University.
Yeah, because that's on the west side of D.C. Yeah, west side of D.C. Yeah,
but see, well, you know, back then, they really didn't allow blacks to travel past 16th Street a lot. So, you know, they didn't have blacks. If you were over there on that other side of Rock Creek Park, you better work over there or you really didn't belong over there. You know, things may be changed as time goes on, but, you know, we had never been on the other side of the Rock Creek Park, you know, for me.
Right.
You know, we had never gone past St. John's. I mean, because that's, we just didn't have, you know, we never did that.
Yeah, well,
so
D.C. back then was, I guess, sort of polarized. The blacks that lived in town lived on the east side of town, northeast and southeast. You did have some blacks that lived on the west side, but well, once you cross that 16th Street boundary, you know, up the Gold Coast and all that, what you're talking about, the demographics, it totally changed.
Oh, yeah. It was a different world. You see, I wasn't used to that. So they took me up to the campus at American University, which is Nebraska and Massachusetts. Man, I had never been in an environment like that, you know, because I grew up on 227
R Street. You have some very... Yeah, very wealthy people that live in that. Still to this day, that live over there.
Oh my goodness, yes, yeah, Fox Hill Road and all that. Oh, you got senators and congressmen, and you know, you got a lot of very rich people over there by American University. And so they took me up there and looked at the camp. I had never had blinds on my bedroom window. I had never had air conditioning. You know, in D.C., we didn't have air conditioning in bedrooms and stuff like that. And also they took me up to the dorm. I said, oh, my God, this is nice. You got air conditioning, got blinds on the windows. You know, I mean, you got pillows, you got a bed, a nice bed. I said, I'll come to your school. And I went to American University. My father wanted me to go to Maryland University. But I told him, I said, Dad, listen, I didn't even play at Coolidge. A lot of the games I never even got in. I said, yes, I'm improving, but I'm not improving enough, I think, to play at Maryland, because Lefty Driesell had just got there, and Lefty would say, this is going to be the UCLA of the East. And I said, well, okay, well, this maybe these guys may be too good. But what happened, I went to American University. I was happy. You know, I went there, and as a freshman, back then you couldn't play varsity ball as a freshman. You had to play freshman basketball. So because of all my jumping rope 10,000 times a night and working and playing in D.C. Now, here's another thing. I tell people the reason I got so good so fast is because the players in Washington, D.C., they all came to a playground Monday through Thursday, a playground called Rudolph Playground. That's on 3rd.
I'm familiar with it.
3rd in Hamilton, whatever. But all the people, all the good players, Monday through Thursday now, would go to Rudolph Playground. And they were playing. I lived two blocks away from there. So I would go down there and get in some of the games. And every year I got better and better. So when I came down there as a senior or junior, I got picked right away. You'd have hundreds of people down there on that playground. If John Thompson would come down with all of his players from St. Anthony's. You had Austin Carson. 10 of us that played on that playground made the NBA or the ABA. That'll never happen again. That because it was AAU basketball and everything else like that. So when I went as a freshman at American University, I averaged about 18 points and about 23 rebounds a game. So from sitting on the bench.
Well, now you led the country. You led the country at AAU
my junior year. My junior and senior year, I led the nation in rebounding. My sophomore year, I came in second to Artis Gilmore, and Dr. J was number three. So I was just in good shape. I mean, one thing about rebounding, you have to be aggressive, and you just have to be in great shape to go get the ball. And because of jumping the rope 10,000 times every night with a 20-pound weight vest or running the stairs with the weight vest, see, I never missed a night working out. I never missed a day working out. I was fanatical trying to be good. And I didn't realize, honestly, that I didn't know what I was doing. If somebody had told me 20 rebounds a game was a lot of rebounds, well, I would have said, oh, okay. But nobody told me that. So when the ball went up there, I went and got it because I was just in better shape than everybody. And then I started lifting weights. My coach started me lifting weights, and, gosh, I mean, I gained 80 pounds in 4 years of college through lifting weights.
Uh-huh.
And I was very fanatical about that. I'd lift weights every day. And because when I went to college, I was 6 foot. I grew up to be 6'8". I weighed 160. Listen to this, 160 my freshman year. When I graduated, I was 240. And that's just through working. I just worked out, run the stairs, lift weights. And they didn't have really good people to teach you about weightlifting back there because nobody really lifted weights. And so, you know, as time went on, I just said, well, okay, maybe this will work or maybe this will work. But because this was the first time in my life I was able in college to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I had never eaten breakfast, lunch, and dinner in my life. And I went to college, and they had all this food was free. I said, this is wonderful. I mean, you could eat as much as you want. I had never been to that.
Right.
So
they had a training table back then for college players.
No, they didn't. They didn't have anything. You just went to cafeteria. Like
my school. At my school, they had a training table for athletes. It was the same food that the other students got, but you just got more of it if you wanted it. They called it the training table.
Well, at American University, you can eat as much as you wanted there. You could keep going up there and get as much food as you wanted. And I had never had the ability to eat like that. You know, I never. I mean, and so I just kept gaining weight. But because I worked out so much, you know, I graduated. I gained 80 pounds in 4 years. And that's how I made pro ball. I was big enough and strong enough, and I was in good enough shape. And, I mean, and because of living in D.C. and playing on the playgrounds, I knew I could play with anybody. You just know that. You're playing down in D.C., which is very rough. It's very rough basketball. It's not just you go out in the suburbs. You in basketball, they're tough, they're aggressive, and you better be able to play. The bottom line.
Right. Kermit, do you remember a guy, he passed on a number of years ago, when, I don't know, Chuck Taylor? He was one of my coaches for the youth teams.
Well, you know what, he was one of the assistant coaches at American University.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. When I was playing, he was one of the assistant coaches. He was like the recruiter. He went out and recruited. He was a good guy. You know, he had twins. I don't remember, but he was a good guy.
I remember when I played youth games, I went over his house with one of the other players on the youth games. I remember they were infants back then, but, I lost track of him after I graduated high school, and then Butch McAdams, but I haven't talked to Butch McAdams, man, in years. A lot of people that I don't know a whole lot of people that would have known him, but in my opinion, he was like, looking back on a basketball icon to me, he knew a lot of the players coming out of D.C. But, you know, I never knew what happened to him. I heard he passed away, and that's all, but nobody knows any details.
Oh, he's a good guy. I'm sorry to hear that because he was one of the – I wouldn't say he was officially assistant, but they used him as a recruiter. Because D.C., now here's the thing about American University, we still have the highest winning percentage my senior year in the history of the school. We were 21-4 in the regular season, but then we got beat by Louisville in the tournament. But the thing is that that year we beat Georgetown, Syracuse, St. John, Virginia Tech. We were good. And all the guys that were on the team back then were from D.C. I was at Coolidge. Wilbur was from Roosevelt. Johnny Lord was from Anacostia. You had Lloyd Mays from Cadoza. You had Steve Garrett from Damantha. I mean, we had all the guys. You had another guy named from Western. Is it Western High School still there anymore?
No. They closed down Western years ago, decades ago. I don't know. I don't know if that became Duke Ellington, but the name Western, no, they closed that down. Morphed it into Duke Ellington, something like that. You went from American University, then I imagine you got drafted by the NBA. So tell us that transition.
Well, first of all, they tried to get me out of college my sophomore year. This is when the NBA could not take you out of college, but the ABA could take you out of college early and sign you. So my sophomore year on the Miami Floridians asked me to come out. I said, heck no. I said, finally, I'm playing a little bit of good basketball, and they wanted me to come out. I said, no. My junior year, the New York Nets wanted me. I was going to be their first-round draft pick, and I told them no, I didn't want to come out. I was having too much fun in college. I was just happy, and that was the happiest I'd ever been in my life. I said, I'm not coming out. They offered me $500,000 for 5 years. That's $100,000 a year, and this is 1972 or 71.
That's when $100,000 will have been really $100,000.
Oh, hey, $100,000. Back then, you could buy a house for $20,000. You know, it was a different world. But I was happy, and my coach called me in and said, "Well, Kermit, they want to draft you in the first round. Or do you want to go? You leave?" I said, "No, coach, I'm happy." I said, "All right, that's the truth." I told him, "Coach, I'm happy. I mean, I've never been so happy in my life. I mean, I said, I'll be first round draft pick next year too. So it's no problem." And because we were only 16-8 that year, and we could have been better, but I knew that Wilbur Thomas was going to join the team from Roosevelt, and he was the best freshman they had ever had at a school except for me, and so I knew we were going to be good. So I said, "No, I'm gonna stay." And so that year we were 21-4, and then in playoffs, then in the tournament we got beat by Louisville, but we were good. I mean, we were a good team, and it was fun. I mean, the happiest time of my life, and I've had a lot of happy years, but my happiest years of my life were in college. And I got drafted by the Lakers. I was the fifth player picked in the draft. Because I was first-team All-American at American University, the first All-American they've ever had. It was me, Bill Walton, Jamal Wilkes, Doug Collins, and Eddie Ratcliffe from Long Beach State.
Ed Ratcliffe here from Long Beach State. He was on the Olympic team. I remember him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was like a 6'6 guard, something like that.
6'6 guard, yes. And so that I basically got drafted as fifth player picked, and so I went to the Lakers, and the Lakers had just gone to the championship that year and gotten beat by New York. So when they drafted me, and for some reason they got a high draft pick. Usually if you're a good team, you draft long farther back in the draft. But I was fifth player. They told me, "We don't need you right now. You know, we want you in a couple of years." I said, "Oh, I'll play." I knew it. See, first of all, you're naive. You don't realize all of a sudden I'm going to be playing against 30-year-old men, 32, 33-year-old men who are good, and I'm 21 years old. So I sat on that bench for the first couple, like 2.5 years before I got off.
Okay.
And so it took me, I went to the general manager whose name was Pete Newell. And he was a famous coach before he became general manager with the Lakers. And I told him, I said, you need to work with me. I said, the coaches are good guys, but both of my coaches back then were point guards, Bill Sharman and let me see who else. I forgot his last name. But Bill Sharman was a point guard, and the other coach was a point guard, and I was playing the four position. I need somebody to teach me. I said, come on, you got to work with me. And they didn't know how to help me. They didn't. Now, honestly, they just didn't know how to help me because they didn't play that position. That's like me working with a guard. I can't really help a guard. I know what a guard does, but I don't know the fundamentals that are needed for a guard to be successful. And so okay. I went to Pete Newell. I knew Pete Newell was a famous coach, and he had won the NCAA championship. He was an Olympic gold medal coach winner. And he won the NIT. I said, well, you can help me. He said, well, I can't work with you because it'll be embarrassing to the head coach and everybody. Well, the third year, he retired. And he said, okay, now I will work with you. So he worked with me every day during the summer. And from that point on, I started playing a lot in the NBA, became a starter because I needed somebody to show me how to be forward. I had played center in college. I needed to learn to be the forward position. And he taught me.
Right.
He worked me very, very hard. And it worked me very hard. And I became a starter for the rest of my career.
All right. Now, you played with the Lakers and whatever teams in the National Basketball Association?
I went to the Celtics. From the Celtics, I went to the Clippers, the first year of the Clippers in San Diego. From the Clippers,
okay.
I went to Portland. And from Portland, I really, I went and played with Golden State for a very short time. My body had given out. I mean, it just couldn't take it anymore. And nowadays, where the guys don't have to practice, I could have kept playing. But back then, you had to practice and the hard practices, and my body could never recover. You gave me a day or two off, yes, my body would be, recovered. But back then, it was very strict back then. It was not like it is nowadays where guys take off from games. I can't believe you take off games and you're healthy. I mean, which is not fair to the fans. Fans pay all that money to come see a game, and all of a sudden you're sitting on the bench because the coach wants to rest you or you want to rest. I've never heard of that. But that's the way things
are. That's true. I remember back in the day like I enjoy watching Pete Maravich play in person, and I would have been disappointed if I went to the game and he didn't get in again. I mean, he didn't get on the court at all. So,
what you're saying is true. Now, if they're going to hold a player out, hold him out at a home game because they get a chance to see him 41 times. A lot of people,
right.
like LeBron. Well, if he – listen, parents will save up money to be able to take their kids to one game the whole year to see LeBron, and then all of a sudden he's sitting on the bench because he's resting. They're resting him. That's not fair. The parents saved all that money. Most parents don't have money to take kids to the games anymore. A good ticket is $250, $300 a game. And then all of a sudden he's sitting on the bench. That doesn't work to me. I don't care for that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. Well, now let's fast forward because the most interesting part of the story, at least that I know about, is that you are helping children or helping feed people in Africa. And built clinics over there and that type of thing. So share that part of the story because, I like the humanitarian part of your story.
Okay. Well, first of all, I had a charity. My last year in the NBA, now this is the start of the charity, I told the owner of the charity, if I make the team, if I can play one more year, I'm donating my whole salary to the people of Portland and start a charity. Well, I didn't make it that year, but I felt bad because I was going to donate my whole salary. But what I did, though, I said I can have an all-star game, a summer all-star game. And nobody believed I could pull it off because Portland Trailblazers, I said, if you help me, I can get the players to come play in those summer, you know, the summer games. So I got Karl Malone, John Stockton, Clyde Drexler, Larry Nance, Dominique Wilkins, all the Portland team. And we raised enough money, as much money as I would have made my last year in the NBA to start the charity. So the charity started about 1985. But then what happened,
okay.
we were feeding people in Portland, a lot of people in Portland. Like every Thanksgiving, every Christmas, we would have used like four or five inner city schools, and we would have dinner for people. Well, then what happened, Nike, Phil Knight of Nike said, well, Kermit, have this program where the inner city schools, I would go around to the inner city schools, and the kids that made honor roll, the honor roll, they would get a free pair of Nike. So that program went on for 4 or 5 years. And then what happened in Africa, Rwanda. Did you ever hear of Rwanda? Rwanda, the genocide? Well, people were slaughtered. And my daughter, who was watching television, said, Dad, you got to do something about that. Yeah, look at all these people that are dying. So I said, okay, Dana. And my daughter's name was Dana. I said, well, I'll call the charity and I'll donate some money for that situation that's happening in Africa. So I called an organization. It was Northwest Medical Teams. And I said to Northwest Medical Teams, I said, I want to donate some money for you guys going over to Africa with doctors and nurses. Well, he said, well, Kermit, we know who you are. We'd love to have your money, but we'd like you to go with us. I said, go with you to Rwanda, where there's 1 million people have been killed. They said, if you go, you'll help us bring awareness to what's going on over there in Africa. I said, well, let me think about it for a weekend. And my daughter and my brother said, you need to go, Dad. You need to help people. I said, Lord have mercy, you're going to get me killed over there. So I called the people. I said, I'll go. I'll come. Let's go. I'll go with you. So I get on the plane with some doctors and nurses, volunteers, and we fly over to, first of all, I fly to London, from London back to Kenya, Nairobi, Kenya, then to Entebbe, Uganda, and from Entebbe, Uganda, we flew into Goma, Zaire, and which is right next to Rwanda, where all the refugees are hitting because there was a conflict between two factions, the Hutus and the Tutsis, and many people were slaughtered. We're not talking about guns. They just hacked them to death or beat them to death with clubs. It was awful. So I worked in the refugee camp in the Red Cross area for like a week. And I had never been around people that were dying or were dead. Those people didn't have any water, no shelter, no food, nothing. They were told to pack up and walk out that country, which was only about 15 miles away from where we were. And they were like 300,000 people at that camp, refugee camp. Most of them had no food, no water, no shelter, no bathrooms, no nothing. And I had never been around that situation. And that's when I started saying, hey, I can help these people. And not only those people, but people in general. And so I came back. It's a long story, but I came back 35 times to Africa. I paid for a clinic to be built. I started schools. I helped people start businesses. We were feeding maybe 40, 50,000 people a year. Then the NBA, when I started working for the NBA union, Billy Hunter, who was running it, started helping. He came over, and they were feeding the NBA union, which is the ball players, probably about 1 million people a year. I'm serious, 1 million people a year.
Okay.
And you don't hear about that. You won't hear about that, but they were feeding about 1 million people a year. Along with the clinic that I had, we would distribute a lot of the food from my clinic. It was not my clinic, but the clinic I paid for to be built. We started a school. We did so many things over in Africa, and it's only a drop in the bucket what needs to be done in a lot of countries. And I just didn't realize that people suffered so much in other countries. I mean, people here might be hungry. Those people over there are starving. And it's not that they're not willing to work. There's just no jobs. So what I started doing is started helping them start businesses by giving them money to start a little, you know, food business or business to whatever they needed. And a lot of them succeeded, and a lot of them didn't succeed. But with the situation, well, I had that situation where our federal government saw it as something that they said it wasn't, but it was. And that's another long story, why I was incarcerated. And because they said, now that I was over there for 24 years working, spending my money. I mean, I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. But our government, because somebody below me was doing something illegal, selling counterfeit software for my charity, which I didn't know anything about. And because I was a CEO and a founder, they come after me. But, you know, the funny thing about, not funny at all, I took a polygraph test and I passed it with flying colors. You know, they say, well, you didn't put any money in. Well, the polygraph test is on YouTube. Just look for Kermit Washington, the polygraph test, and you'll see that I passed it all. I put close to $300,000 of my own money into charity. Everything that I did, said I did, I did. But the government didn't want to hear that. So they went after some of the doctors and the nurses. All of them were innocent. All those people were good people. But I wasn't going to let something happen to them. So what I said is, I'll take a plea agreement if the people that you're going after, you'll let them go. Because I knew they weren't guilty of anything. But because the guy way below me, and he didn't really work for me, he just sold like memorabilia. Like Michael Jordan would give me signed shoes. Magic would give me stuff. Kareem would give me stuff. I would give it to him, and he lives in the Baltimore area. Not Baltimore area, Maryland area. And he would sell it, and I said, well, you can have 20% of what you sell. One day he says, well, can I start selling some stuff on eBay under your charity? I said, yeah, but you've got to donate some of that money that you sell. You just can't come on and start selling because eBay gives us a benefit for being a 501c3 with a charitable organization. Well, all of a sudden he starts selling counterfeit software from China, him and his partners. And I knew nothing about it, absolutely nothing. And on a polygraph test, which is a long polygraph test, though, but it's on YouTube, it says, I knew nothing about it when Kermit passed, Washington passed. And the feds were saying that, well, I didn't put any money in it. And the polygraph test shows I put about $300,000. Now, I didn't have $300,000 that I really could afford to put in. But for over the years, when people needed stuff, I was willing to pay for different things, like the clinic to be built, bought a car for the clinic, paid for food for the people, paid for medicine, paid for all the doctors. I must have taken 30 doctors over and nurses over to Africa to do free clinics where we were seeing 1,000 people a day. Most of those people had never been to a doctor in their life. So it's a long story. I wrote a book in 2020, The Kermit Washington Story, and it's in that book that I wrote.
I think it's available on Kindle online.
I think you can still get it at Barnes & Noble or online. Just look it up. But, you know, I don't know. I wasn't out to promote it. See, that's the problem. It was doing good before I was incarcerated. And
okay.
But the other thing is it took me a year and a half, 2 years to write it. And, you know, but it's the truth. And then on the polygraph test, like the funny thing, the Fed said, well, everything in the book is not true. Well, if you look at the polygraph test, I passed. Everything in the book I wrote is true. But you don't have to understand that the judicial system is not always looking for the truth. Sometimes they're looking for what they want to look for. And so it was newsworthy to have an ex-ball player found guilty of something they thought that I was doing, where, in my opinion, to be honest with you, I should have been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm telling you the truth. For 24 years, we've helped hundreds of thousands of people build clinics. But here's the thing. We were very quiet about everything we did. You know, we didn't want people to pat us on our back. I didn't want people to say, oh, what a great job you did. No, we helped people because people needed help. That's the bottom line.
Right.
You know, now if I had been more vocal and more out in the public about what we did, well, the feds would have never come after me, because you know, because everybody would have known what I did. And just like, I'll give you another good example. On Long Beach, out here in California, I would go every month and feed about 1,000 people a month for years, and nobody knew about it except for the manager of the grocery store and a few people like that. That's it. Nobody else knew. Because you know, I don't do things for people to say, oh, great job. When I see a need, if I can help, I will help. You know, because the feds, I told the feds, who gets on a plane, goes over to Rwanda, works over there, builds clinics, and you're saying they're doing something illegal? I said, there's no such thing. You don't go to Rwanda. You don't go to Africa 25 times, pay all these hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay for doctors and nurses to go over with you to help hundreds of thousands of people because you have some kind of alternate plan, alternative motive. There's no such thing.
Right.
But we know that we, as unfortunately black people, aren't viewed in a very positive way by people in power. You know, they think we can't be doing good things because we want to do good things. It has to be some alternative motive that we do things like that. That's just, you know, that's how we live as a minority. And we just have to, as I was listening to your show before, we have to learn to come together and give ourselves power over these people that are in government, and they view us in certain negative ways and don't give us opportunities or don't give us credit for what we've done.
Right, right. Well, now you've got a podcast of your own, I believe. I just heard you on the Butch McAdams radio show a couple of weeks ago. Now, tell us about your podcast and how we can listen to it.
Well, it's called 20 and 20 Podcast of Kermit Washington. And it's on YouTube. We put it on Facebook and Instagram. What I'll do, if they come on, well, I have no more room on Facebook. But Instagram, if you try to join me on Instagram, I feel you can have as many people there as you want. And I can let people know how they can listen to it. Our first person we had was Hasim Watson.
What's your Instagram? How can we find you on Instagram?
Well, it's Kermit Washington, Kermit.Washington. But here's what I'll do. I'll call you back and make sure I can give you all the information for everywhere people can find all the stuff that we do. We just started. We just did three other shows the other day. We have to edit them, and they come out nice. And I didn't realize how much goes into the podcast with all the equipment that you have to have and the editing and stuff, because we don't do it live. We shoot the show, and then we have to edit it. Maybe it takes 3 or 4 days to edit it, and then we put it on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, everything else like that. But it's called the 20 and 20 Podcast with Kermit Washington. So I'll get you all the rest of the information when you need, okay?
All right. Now, what are some of the topics that you've covered on that so far?
Well, basically, it's football, it's basketball, it's boxing. And what we were just talking about the other day is about, we talked about boxing with Hasim, and then we talked about basketball and then football. And we were talking about the different sports and different reasons. Like, all of a sudden now with the NFL, the big topic now, well, they have 17 games. And they keep saying these stats are being broken. Well, when we were growing up, there were only 12 games in an NFL season. So why do they compare, let's say, a 1,000-yard rusher? It means nothing anymore. Now, a 1,000-yard rusher back when it was only 12 games is very impressive. But when you have 17 games, you're only averaging 50-some yards a game, game in rushing. And all of a sudden, all these records are breaking. But heck, you're going from 12 games to now to 17 games, and then you're still measuring people with the same standards that you had when they were 12 or 14 games?
That's a serious double standard, Now, do you plan on covering or doing any other work on the continent of Africa?
Well, you know what? I don't know how long before I have permission to go over. But see, another thing you have to realize, when I was incarcerated, I was doing very well financially, but with paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for attorneys, losing a whole lot. I mean, like 4 or 5 years of not working and still trying to pay some little bit of bills. No, I don't have the finances to do that. That's why I want the podcast to do really well. And you, as you know, you don't make money with the podcast as opposed to, let's say, bringing people on that want to advertise certain things. But first you have to get a huge following. And so that's what we have to work on. I mean, we just did, like, my Facebook does well. Instagram does okay. But we have to work. We have to learn how to be good at what we do. But one good thing is I can get really good guests. You know, I get a lot of ex-NBA players, a lot of people that – a lot of ex-football players, baseball players, because I know so many. And announcers or boxers and people like that.
I've got a guy – forgive me for interrupting. Out of D.C., you probably have met him. I don't know. Walter Ray, if you're listening, press 1 and we can patch you into the conversation. He's an attorney. He's got a 501. He's got an organization called EGOS, which stands for Education, Goals, Opportunity, and Sports. I met him in high school when we played basketball at Paint Branch. And his sister's, she does sports and entertainment law herself. But Walt, if you're listening, just press 1 so we can patch into the conversation. But I'm sure we can probably collaborate on some stuff because I'm interested in East Africa myself. I'm into solar energy and all that type of stuff now. So, but we got a hand up in the audience. 262 area code. Your mic is on. I mean, your mic is open. You're speaking to Kermit Washington. I mean, with Kermit Washington.
Hello?
Grand Rising and happy Kwanzaa.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Welcome. You're welcome. Thank you so much for continuing to be a leader in the community. I like the fact that you are speaking of being accountable. Giving back doesn't always mean monetarily. However, we want to be supportive and, you know, we don't always have to agree, but just to give another an opportunity, even with social media, we can agree to disagree at times, but just to give one another that space. I appreciate everything that I'm hearing here. And I'd like to extend an invitation if you're in the Chicago area. On Friday, February 3rd, we have an educational conference at or any of the former pro players that you know to stop in. They would just need to call 262-733-4080, and I'll put them on the VIP guest list.
Well, we lost her there.
Okay.
I think it just repeated my, I don't know why it just, there was an echo, a triple echo seems like. So, yeah, we're having an educational conference, and then the second half of the evening, my live band will perform. The theme is called Celebrate Your Life. So we just want to figure out ways or continue to share ways for young people to be encouraged about the lives that they're living. And from sports to entertainment to traditional careers, we just want to get some positive role models in front of them, community leaders. So we're celebrating community leaders on that day at the Grand Ballroom Chicago, by the way.
That sounds good. I won't be able to make it, but, you know, I'm very proud of you for doing that and helping and waking up these kids that start, you know, really – and to make it in this society nowadays, you've got to work. You know, you have to put the effort out educationally wise and everything else like that. And one thing I try to tell a lot of these young people, you can learn. I don't care with the internet, with the things that they get, you don't have to always learn everything in school. You can educate yourself with the computers, with the internet. Everything you want to know is on the web. You can learn. And you just have to learn because, you know, I hate to say this, most people don't want you to make it. you know, they're happy when you don't make it because it gives them the opportunity to make it. So with a lot of kids, I try to tell them, I said, you got to put the effort out. I mean, when you're in high school or junior high school, yeah, you got a lot of friends. You're having fun. When you get out in this world out here, to make it, to be successful, okay, you got to put in the work. You have to put in work, just like in sports.
All right. Let's see. Walt, you might have to call back in. We have Walter Ray from D.C. Hang up and call back in, because when I open up your mic, we have that echo. If anybody else wants to speak with Kermit Washington, 269-768-2945, or if you're in the studio already, just press 1. And Reba, I'm going to open up your mic again. Reba, you have any other questions from Kermit Washington?
Yes. I actually wanted to know if you were – we had an NBA player, a former NBA player, to visit DeSable High School when I was teaching there. The alumni group invited someone out. I'm trying to remember the name. But in addition to that, I've met Mr. 7000, and that's baseball. But, you know, I was like, Mr. 7000. He said, look up my name, you know. So I'm just excited to just be in connection, and I could share with the young people that I work with, who actually they have a light hauling business, and we do rent trucks to do, you know, larger jobs as well. But we, along with the leadership of Brother L.A., are going to build a tiny mobile solar cabin the morning of our evening event, so that we can show how we're giving back to the community. Besides moving, you know, seniors, we've even moved Gene Chandler, the Duke of Earl.
Mm-hmm.
You guys remember Duke of Earl? Yeah.
Oh, I remember that song.
That was exciting.
I was a little kid then. Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, when we pulled up, I said, you are a musician, because I'm a singer. I teach Spanish as well. I'm an educator. But then I'm a singer, and I can identify, you know, not just by the swag, but just by the mannerisms and even the voice at times. I said, you are a musician, aren't you? You know, he said, I'll tell you later. And then so I asked him, I said, yeah, it takes one to know one. I said, I'm a singer. I know you. You know, I had never met him before. But then we got to his storage facility. He said, Gene Chandler. I was like, what? I told my sons, I said, I always, one of my sons, and then DeAndre Comer, he actually is a young leader who takes young men out to help move people too. They never have any issues, and it's a way to keep them off the street. So I just wanted to know if you would put some of the Chicago-based or in the area, the former NBA players and those that you know, to get them to maybe come out and just give us a couple of words of encouragement for our young people during our fundraiser on February 3rd at the Grand Ballroom, Chicago.
Well, you know what? Get the information there to him, and he can maybe get it to me, and then I can maybe put it on my podcast and let people know if they hear about it. The ballplayers, maybe they might be interested in coming. That's what I can do for you. So
awesome. And Brother LA, yeah, we're actually partners in this thing. He's one of our sponsors. And okay. So yeah, this will be our first build together, but Brother LA has done them before. So thank you for that. And I appreciate you once again. And your podcast, I'd love to get the young people to check out your podcast. Once again, what is your podcast? Because I heard you guys mention
it. It's on YouTube. It's 20 and 20, you know, Kermit Washington podcast, 20 and 20. Because now the reason it's 20 and 20, I'm the last college player to average 20 points and 20 rebounds for my career. Nobody has done it in 50-some years. So that's why we need the 20 and 20. Some people think it's an eyesight chart. No, it was just I'm the last player in the history of college basketball to average 20 points and 20 rebounds for my career. So that's why we named it 2020.
And that's okay. a lot of work. Those 20 rebounds, that work.
Well, you know what it is, though? As I told you, I didn't know that was a lot of rebounds. I just knew that because I used to jump rope. Now, I don't exaggerate anything. 10,000 times a night with a 20-pound weight vest, I jump rope. It took me about an hour and 20 minutes every night to jump rope like that. But I got so good so fast, when I say good so fast, athletically. Now, basketball-wise, it took a little bit longer to understand how to be a good basketball player, but I could jump. I could dunk the ball. I could do anything close to the basket I could do. And so I tell people it takes work to be good. I mean, it does, because you have everybody who wants to be a basketball player. Because anytime there's money you can make, people want that job. They want that job.
That's true. All right, Walter Ray, you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay,
yeah, Walt, we can hear you. We can hear you.
Okay, great. How you doing, Mr. Washington?
Fine. How are you today?
I'm fine. I grew up in the D.C. area about 10 years behind you. I lived on Ingraham Street off in the northwest section. I went to Ingraham. My uncle is Sam Jones. He played on the old Celtics. And
I knew Sam.
Yeah, I know. He used to speak very highly of you. And I went to Gethsemane Baptist Church. That was my nursery school. And we used to leave there. I went to Rudolph, the school you were talking about, and we used to come and watch you all play. But at that time, we still thought we were baseball players. I didn't fall in love with basketball until I got about 12 or 13.
Well, so, you know, the funny thing, back then in D.C., if you remember, I don't remember how old you are, but they had great playground managers where they had 10 and under baseball teams, 12 and under, 14 and under. They had basketball.
Yes.
They had a playground director that would have all those things. So we always had something to do, which is good.
Yes,
I don't know if they have any of that anymore.
Yes. I tell L.A. that back in those days, the rec departments, the rec leagues were structured. So that was basically the AAU, the feeder system to schools. That's where the Chuck Taylors and the Fluff Parkers, they all were affiliated with the rec departments, and they had their eye on all the D.C. talent, probably in a better way than the AAU, who were doing it through tennis shoe companies and stuff. And,
yeah, that's true.
And I also tell L.A. that you and I have another kind of connection with him. I moved from D.C. when I was about 10 years old, and when we moved, we went to Paint Branch, and your sister went to Paint Branch, and L.A. went to Paint Branch. Yep, L.A.
Yeah,
went to Paint Branch as well. So the world gets.
And my brother, my brother went there too.
Really?
Victor Washington Victor Washington and Tracy Washington. Yes.
I remember them. I remember both of them.
Right off Route 29, right?
From Colesville Road, Burtonsville, and it was the way Tracy Jackson went, the great Tracy Jackson, and
yes,
Lee actually played with him. Yes, and that was their identity when they first got there. Well, that's Kermit Washington's sister, bro.
Telling
Lee, the world gets small. The world gets real small, real if you talk long enough.
Yeah, well,
and I got to drop another. I have to drop another name on you because I know when you went to AU, like you said, that was your first steak and your first meal. But I know after you got entrenched and started understanding the history of AU sports, I know you learned about the legend of Will Jones, because if they didn't tell you, I know he did.
Well, Will Jones, I used to, you know, Will Jones, first of all, he would come up to the place, it would be a varsity against the alumni, and he would come up there, he was 30-some years old, still kill us. He was a great player. Not a good player, he was a great player.
Great player, yes.
Yeah. I heard that he passed a couple of years ago.
He did. I actually interviewed him. I have him on tape. I have a lot of them on tape talking about the old D.C. basketball. And another legend just passed. It was of your era when you were in Inner High. I went to his service about a month ago, Apple Milam.
Oh, Apple?
Apple
was
just
one of the
died,
best
yeah.
I tell you, that McKinney Tech team was one of the best teams probably in the history of Washington, D.C. You had Randy. You had Tatum. You have Bozard, you have Bassett, You had who else? You had a guy that we used to wear Ronnie Hogue.
Yeah.
Like four guys. All five guys got Division I scholarships, and you had two that made pro ball. Ronnie Hogue made it and Tim Bassett made it. So Tim played for the Nets, and Ronnie Hogue, I don't know who he played for, but he played for a short time in the league too. But Randy was the most Apple was the most talented of all them all.
Yeah, they say it was just hard to keep him focused on basketball in school alone.
Yeah, and he just – I don't know why he didn't – well, first of all, he didn't have the SAT scores because Maryland wanted him. Lefty Giselle wanted him really badly. But for some reason, I don't remember what it was, they couldn't get him. And they had the little point guard. It was little Tatum, I think his name was. Was fast.
Yeah.
And that was a great team. Great – you know what, back then people don't understand – they didn't have a lot of television stations. They didn't have any games people play. Nobody had a car. You might have Calvin Coolidge High School, where I went, out of 1,500 students, you had two cars. Two guys had cars. That's it. So they didn't have all these other distractions. So I give you a good example. The Christmas tournament was at Maryland University at Cole Field House. You would have 10,000 people there trying to get in. 10,000 would get in. You have another 2,000 or 3,000 outside trying to get in. That's when they had DeMatha, Mackin, McKinley Tech, Spingarn, or somebody. St. John's. Basketball was huge. High school basketball was huge. Is it still huge like that now in D.C.?
No, the AAU people have kind of sabotaged or undermined the grassroots. A spirit of it where they turned it total corporate. You have kids that are 10 years old saying they don't play on the playgrounds because they're worried about their knees. I said, you don't have knees when you're 10 years old, do you?
No, I mean, we played on the playground
not concerned. You're definitely not concerned about them. But
yeah, it was 100 degrees. We'd be out there on that playground, 100 degrees.
Exactly. But Sam always spoke highly of you. I talk about those playgrounds because when we used to play on the playground, and we came, like I said, about 10, 12 years behind you all, and I remember literally we'd be out there playing pickup, and Red Auerbach would walk up on the court just coming to watch a pickup game.
No, he certainly would. He certainly would. Red Auerbach, I mean, you know what? He was the first really to integrate basketball, you know, you bring in black players, and he didn't care. As long as you could play, he didn't care if you were purple. You know, he just wanted some good players. Yeah, that's the way he is. I knew him ever since I was 17 years old, Red Auerbach.
You know what's crazy is Sam, like I said, is my uncle, and his son, Aubrey, they do something they call the I'll get them on your podcast. They do something with John Feinstein, who wrote that book about you.
Yeah,
and they go to Bethesda. Red Auerbach used to love Chinese food. So once a week, he would get Sam, John Thompson, John Feinstein. He would get all the VIPs, and they would come and listen to Red Auerbach tell stories at the China Doll in downtown D.C.
Where they play the NBA games now. I don't know the name of the stadium anymore. I mean, where does play? What do they call that place now?
Verizon Center in Chinatown.
Verizon Center in Chinatown.
And the restaurant was over there too, right? Is that correct? Where they would go, Red Auerbach. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and they would tell, he would talk about how he has known you since you were a kid. Red Auerbach, literally, I've heard that with my own ears, where your name would come up, and he knew you from camps, he knew you growing up,
here's the reason why. I'm going to tell you this funny story. His daughter went to American University, and the girl that I was dating was friends with her, and she needed a ride home one day. And, I said, we can give her a ride home. And we gave her a ride home, but I didn't know her father was Red Auerbach. Her name was Randy Auerbach.
I knew it was either Randy or Nancy.
Randy was at American University. Nancy was older. She had graduated from college at that point. But here's the thing. So we're taking her home and off New Mexico Avenue. And so, first of all, we thought that Red Auerbach lived in Boston. We didn't know he lived over there in D.C. So So yeah. I knew her last name was Arbeck, but I never put two and two together. We walk into her house, and I see all this Boston Celtics stuff. I said, well, who is your dad? Well, my dad's Red Arbeck. I said, oh, my God, let's get out of here. As I'm trying to turn and get out the door, he's walking in the door. He said, go sit down, young man. I want to talk to you. That's how I met Red Arbeck when I was 17. I was a freshman at American University. Freshman
wow.
is taking her home. So that's how I met him. And from that point on, we were friends. And unfortunately, when I got in that trouble with the big fight, and it wasn't with Rudy Tomjanovich. That's what makes me so sick to this day. His center punches Kevin Koonin, punches me in the face, elbows me in the face, and I got in an altercation with him. And as he's going down, I see Rudy running from behind me. What am I supposed to think? We come from D.C. Come on.
I was about
come
to
on.
Bring
we
that go, up. D.C.?
We don't come from the suburbs where, oh, he's going to come and shake our hands. We, you know, we think he's coming to get you. And so,
yeah.
you know, something. And that's what, you know, that's what happens. You get people saying, well, why did you hit him? His teammate has elbowed me in the face, punches me in the face, and he's a seven-footer. And I knew you know, let me be honest with you. I knew I could take him. And then
right.
when we're getting in a fight, I turn and I see Rudy running at me. What do I think? Come on. What do I think?
Yeah.
But you know what? When you're black, you know,
when
you're
black, was a different league back then.
Listen. There are rules for whites and there's rules for blacks still to this day. We're viewed differently. You know, when you have a person that's from the suburbs, they said, why did you think he was going to hit you? Well, why do you think his teammate was punching me in the face? You know, and he's the one that started the whole altercation and changed my life completely. But
wow.
in everything, in the NBA or whatever, you know, it's we as minorities, we have different rules we live by, unfortunately. We have different ways we are viewed. You know, that's why so many young people are getting shot by police because they mistook their actions when they were, you know, they weren't doing anything wrong. But because
yeah.
they were black, they're viewed like, oh, man, he was getting ready to pull a gun. Well, he wasn't pulling a gun. Well, because that's what
yeah.
we thought he was going to do. And that, see, but as a black person, where one guy who is white, both were white, Kevin Cooner, elbows me in the face and punches me in the face, and then I have his teammate running at me from behind, what am I supposed to think? But you know what?
No doubt.
The white public went after me. Boy, they went. Listen, they suspended me for 3 months, had the biggest fine in the history of the school. And to this day, I have people still bring that up. And that's 40-some years ago.
Wow. You know what? I moved from D.C. to, like I said, the school where your brother and sister went out to Maryland. And we, you know, fighting was like an instinct where you saw that moment might be a threat to you. And, you know, they thought I might have anger management issues. I said, no, wait a minute. that's part of it. And that boys will be boys. They wouldn't even consider that aspect of it. But I definitely understand the different points of view or perspectives of a fist fight. And like you said, you played basketball on the old D.C. playground. So did Lee and I. And, you know, part of that is a little bit of machoism where you can't get chumped or scared. And that's just part of the – and you all came, like Lee said, in a different kind of culture or mindset of the sport where that was a part of the ingredients. I mean, you know, hey, I hockey they fight. You know, everything they fight, basketball they fight, and all of a sudden it's a crime.
Well, you know, but see, there's no blacks in the hockey ring, you know, so that's okay. Boys will be boys, but not for us. No, we're thugs.
Yeah.
We're thugs. There we call us thugs.
Well,
but what
are the future plans for your podcast? Because you're a visionary, so what's your vision going into 2023?
Well, we're going to have everybody, not just sports on, but everybody. There are all the different subjects that we can bring up for the podcast. But you know what? As I told you, I can get a lot of really good players and really good people because they're my teammates, my ex-teammates or my friends or coaches that I knew. Like Pat Riley was my teammate. You know, Jerry West was my teammate and my coach. You go to all people from all around. And so even though that, you know, one big thing, no matter what happens to me, I mean, my teammates and my friends are still my friends. They don't believe any. They know me for so many years. Just like my college teammates, we were teammates 50 years ago, but we still talk to each other once a week. Most of us talk to the guys that were on American University that, you know, played ball with me. Like five or six of us still talk to each other, at least call to see how everybody's doing. And this is 50 years. So, you know, those bonds will never be broken because, you know, we were together for 4 years there. And I loved it. I told you, it was the best 4 years of my life at American University.
All right. Well, you know, because now Walt Ray, he has helped a lot of people get into college on a scholarship. You two might be able to do some interesting collaborations together. And with your podcast, well, man, if you can tap into the youth market, because my knowledge, nobody's covering that on a podcast level.
No, we are here to support. One thing, when Sam Jones passed last December, about a year ago today, and Sam in 2019, when the Golden State Warriors were playing and they all got injured, like right, you know, Kevin Durant got hurt, Sam signed a basketball for me and my cousins, and it's signed by him and Russell. And he says, you know, Wally, they call me Wally, because I used to go to the camps up in Boston with them. And he said, they're the only team that reminds me of us. He said, if those kids ever win another one, which Steph Curry did last year, he said, you make sure you get him one of these balls, he says, and get one to Kareem. I don't know if you have any access to Kareem, but I would love to get him. It's a ball signed by Russell and Sam, the most rings in the history of the game. One has 11 and one has 10. And nobody's catching that no time soon if it's ever caught at all. So I don't know if you can catch them. I'd love if you could.
Yeah, I'm glad to say now, Walt, you also, Sam Jones did, he did at least two interviews, thanks to you, on this podcast.
Yes, he did.
Kermit, we've been doing this podcast for 9 consecutive years, like December 24th, that's our birthday here. So for 9 consecutive years, and we had Sam on here, thanks to Walt, about, I want to say 3 times, but definitely 2.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's 3, because the third time, one of Red's relative, Red Auerbach's kinfolk, was on here with Sam as well. So we've had him.
I went to the NBA Top 75 ceremony in honor of him, me and my cousins. And, you know, we were in the room with the Kareems and that, and I didn't bring that ball. So I would love to get that to him and Curry. I don't know if you're in touch with Kareem, but I know he loved you as far as the things he wrote about you in his book and the things I've heard him mention. Do you remember when Kareem lived on 16th Street, Mr. Washington?
No. Well, Kareem and I were teammates for 3 years, but, you know, Kareem is an introvert. He is a very quiet intellectual, really, now. And you know what? I haven't talked to him for 4 years. I haven't talked to him for 4 years. But great teammate. You know, I played with 12 Hall of Famers. So, I was very fortunate. And I didn't realize that's a lot, the people I played with. So most players can't say like even Michael Jordan can't say that he's played with 12 Hall of Famers. Well, wait a minute. I only think he played with maybe 2.
Did you play with Lou Hudson?
Lou Hudson, yes. Listen, I played with. Okay. Let me tell you the Hall of Famers. Okay, first of all, Jerry West, Dale Goodrich, Connie Hawkins, Zelmo Beatty, Jamal Wilkes, Adrian Dantley, Kareem, JoJo White. I think Lou Hudson should be there. I don't think he got there yet. John Havlicek, JoJo White, Dave Cowens, and Dave Bing. Chris Mullin. So that's about 12. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I played with some great players, great players. And so,
no doubt.
And, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed playing. I mean, now my favorite sport is football. My brother played pro football. And, after high school, I mean, you always are hurt. And you know what? We had good teams at Calvin Coolidge's football team. I mean, we were good. And the problem was, people don't realize how tough it used to be. You're out there practicing 100-degree weather, 100-degree heat in 2 days. Come on. And back then, they didn't let you have any water during practice. No such thing.
Wow.
Did not have water. They thought you would get cramps or get sick. It was ridiculous. I mean, things have gotten a lot easier for athletes nowadays. No water at all. No water for the 2-3 hour practices. You would sell your soul to the devil for some water. You know, you would have. You would have.
Okay. You got to give us a Petey Green story. I know you got one.
No, you know what? No, I don't have one. I don't have one. Do you have one?
Okay.
No, I don't have. Well, I have. Hey, listen, I have stories about everything. I mean, the great players I played with. I mean, I've met Ollie 3 times. I mean, just name it. I mean, Ken Norton. I mean, because being
Petey, I'm talking about Petey Green, the activist who had his own talk show on Channel 20.
I've heard of him.
Let me give you a story about that. He went to Petey Green was the first guy that was kind of like no holds barred, was saying things that were just kind of unmainstream at the time on TV on Channel 20. And one of your alumni saw him, and that's where he got the idea to go all out and cross the boundary line, was Howard Stern, who went to AU.
Oh, okay.
And Howard Stern went on Petey Green's show and saw how Petey did it and said, I'm going to take a chance and roll the dice on just saying anything, and the rest is history.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing. He's making about $25, $30 million a year saying anything.
and he owes it to a Washington, D.C. broadcaster.
I believe that. But I know Petey Green, but I just don't know him, any of his stories, because I just don't know, unfortunately. But I've heard of him. I think everybody's heard of him.
Yeah. Well, when you were coming along, Petey was in Lorton.
Was that where?
He was in Lorton.
Okay.
Petey's grassroots times were the 40s and the 50s. Because he was born in the 30s.
Well, you know what? When I grew up, it was two stations we listened to, WOOK and WOOK.
That's my sister. Terrible
right.
Turk.
Yeah. I tell you, those are the only stations
when
I went to college.
Here.
It was 100% black music.
Yeah.
100%.
Well, if you lived in Northwest, you remember the time the guy climbed up on the WOOK tower?
Yes, I do remember that. Yes, I do remember that.
Everybody in Northwest remembers that.
And I remember they used to have that dance show that came on in the afternoon.
Yeah.
The dance on WOOK.
Uh-huh.
It was like,
hey, Lee,
like,
David Brooks introduced me to him, Lee.
Well, I tell you.
The guy that went up to the tower?
He climbed up the tower. Back. Yep.
That's a long time.
Wasn't he naked or something? Here, I watched him from my bedroom window. Yeah, because I can see the tower from my bedroom. Let me put this out here to Kermit, and then Walt, you can comment on it too. Now, the way I look at basketball, because like I said, other than maybe a YouTube highlight something, I really don't get into I don't know who the players are or none of that stuff anymore. But what's piqued my interest, and I mentioned this to you the other day, when we spoke, and we talked about it a few times. I think a lot of people, they don't necessarily have to be athletes, need to start looking at. Oh, wait a minute. We got somebody. Hold it. Meet somebody in the background. Hold on. That's not. Okay, wait a minute. I don't know where that's. Okay. Look, all right, the way I look at the game now, because a lot of people, for instance, they talk about, LeBron makes so much money, this person makes so much money. But there's a part of the game that a lot of people don't look at is the people who build the stadium or the arenas, people who make arenas, people who have the maintenance contracts, people who make the shoes, or people that supply the materials to make the shoes. there's also a lot of intellectual problems. Now, I'll start it off with Big Baller Brand. Kermit, what do you think about players, maybe on the – well, you even have some people who have a big IG following now, Instagram following, that might have a shoe contract now. But what about other aspects of the game, like, you know, intellectual property, shoe manufacturing or sportswear manufacturing, or you know, doing charity stuff like you did in Africa? What do you think about those opportunities or exposing the younger people to those opportunities?
Well, first of all, the reason the ball players have that opportunity, they got so much money. They have power. And with the internet, they have a voice, and people, and they're people that will listen to that voice. I mean, it's incredible. It's a different world now. Now, the internet can be your friend and it can be your enemy. It can help to make you or destroy you. So I tell people, you be careful when you get on there. But if you have a voice and you have a good thing to say, a lot of good things can happen from that. I mean, from that. So, like nowadays, you have guys that are ball players. Well, they can change the world. They have that kind of money. They can change the world, or they can change the world for thousands and thousands of people. And I'll give you a good example. Like, well, I told you, in Africa, we were feeding 40,000 people a year, and it wasn't costing us that much money at all. You could buy, I remember when we would go down to buy the food, we could buy, gosh, like 40 pounds of beans for something like $15. And 40 pounds of beans, you know, could feed, you know, after you cook them, they swell up, whatever. It was incredible how we could feed so many people in Africa for such a small amount of money. Now, things have changed as time goes on. It's not the same as easy as it was, because the cost of everything has gone up. And one of the reasons cost of everything has gone up is because of people in Africa, or let me just say this, people in Kenya cannot grow food and make money because we, as our country, America, subsidize the farmers here, and we send food over there to Africa and undermine the Africans who are trying to sell the food themselves. It's an ugly situation because they can't compete. They can't. People in Kenya trying to grow their food themselves for their people, they can't compete. They can't compete because we send subsidized food over there. But the world economy is, you know, and I didn't believe it at first, but the world is run by very powerful people, not by government. That sounds like a conspiracy, but I believe that the world is run by some very powerful, very rich people that are even more powerful than the government. I think, as you were saying, they just have so much control of the situation, what's going on. It's incredible.
Well, Kermit, that's why I play that piece at the beginning of my podcast just about every morning. Booker T. Washington said it. You basically need to get your economics together first. Once you get your economics together and you have the financial base, then you can use government as a tool the way you want to do it. I mean, essentially, business interests basically through lobbyists bankroll legislation.
Oh yeah. You know, money controls everything. Money runs everything. Money runs the military. Well, you know what's funny? Yeah, I know we're off of sports, but I remember when Eisenhower retired from being the president. He says, "Beware of the military going to control the world," and he was so true. I mean, right now, they're spending so many hundreds of millions of dollars and trillions of dollars on certain programs that we don't know anything about, yet we're the ones that pay for it. The poor people, you know, you're paying for it. So,
right.
I don't know what to say sometimes. I just
and
you know,
I'm
telling
another thing now. You
excuse
me. I get so much words in my mind when I'm talking to you. You built a clinic over in Africa. You said
I built a clinic.
All
I
right,
built a clinic.
What
I went
now?
Over there. Listen. I told you what they were taking advantage of me at first because we would go over there. I would take doctors and nurses over, but then we'd have to rent a school or a church to be able to administer the medicine and stuff like that. And so I said after a while, I said, no, this is not going to work. I'm gonna build a clinic, pay for it, and I didn't run it, but I let somebody else have it. And the thing is that I just built it, and they just took over, which is good. And he's still running it to this day.
Okay. Well, the reason why I asked that question is, what about the thought of people learning how to, I mean, because some players, after they finish playing, they don't know, they do something else. But learn how to former players that or kids, exposing kids or anybody of any age that wants to learn how to build. It could be a clinic, it could be in a sports arena or whatever, because, like I say, there's a lot of – everything has to be built, but a lot of people really don't have that skill or at least not enough, in my opinion. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, when I first went to Africa, I would have never thought that I could accomplish what I did. I went over there just to go over there to Rwanda during the genocide and just to help. But when I saw what the situation is, first of all, I had a couple of friends that were doctors and nurses, and I told them, I said, will you go with me back over to Africa? And they said, yeah, I'll go. I paid for their way. And then I promised them, as they came back, I said, I'll let you stay in Europe on my dime. But what happens is that from that little thing, learning I could take doctors, a couple of doctors over, and we would see about 500 people a day. We would stay for like 2 weeks. Then I got to the point where I was taking maybe 15 doctors and nurses over, and I paid for all of it. Nobody paid for any, no doctor paid for any airplane fare, hotels, or anything. I paid for everything. And see, and it, my problem was, and here's the funny thing, not funny, I never kept receipts. But the doctors and nurses know I paid for everything. You know, the transportation, the food in Africa, the medicine, everything. But the thing is that one thing I learned is that as you keep doing something, you can get better at it, and you would have never believed that you could accomplish what you did from the beginning. But as you gradually get better, just like in basketball, just like in sports, or like in education, as you keep working, you say you believe that you can accomplish even more. Well, I can do this now. I didn't think I could do this. No. Then it got to the point where we were seeing, we would go over for 2 weeks, and we would see close to 1,500 people a day. And these people had never seen a doctor before in their lives. And we would see it. We would see them, treat them, do everything that we could, and then we would leave. And then when I could raise enough money again, I would take another group of doctors and nurses over. And the doctors, now, I mean, those were good people. They would go over there. They didn't get paid. I couldn't pay them, but I could pay for their way. I could pay for their food. I could pay for their transportation. And they enjoyed it because during the weekend, like on Saturday and Sunday when we go to Africa, well, they would be off and could do anything they wanted, you know, sightseeing. But Monday through Friday from 7 to 7, we were working, and not good conditions either. I mean, the slums were Kibera, Kawangware. I mean, some really bad – I mean, it's you people here in this country, you can't even imagine the kind of slums that we worked in and these people live in. It's unimaginable. And the education level, you know, those people go to school. They work hard, but there are no jobs for them. That's why they all want to leave these countries and come to America. I mean, just like, you know, these people saying, well, we got to stop the immigration to America. Well, you're never going to stop it. They're going to keep coming. I mean, what do you want them to do, stay in their country and die of starvation and lack of opportunities? You're not. And I'm not. just like you. You're going to try to jump that fence, right? You're not going to sit there and die. No, no. And so
let me overcome. We got another caller. We got another caller for you. Hold on, because I know you're kind of tight on time over there. 309 area code. Your mic is open.
Hey, good morning. Very nice to meet you, Kermit, Mr. Washington.
Thank you. Thank you for calling
in. I've been sitting here listening to the whole show and enjoying every moment of it, listening to what you've done and, you know, talk about not, you know, keeping receipts and all that. And that's because your heart was in it. It wasn't in it for any kind of accolade. I like that. You know, that just shows what kind of character you really are. And, no, I'm very, very excited that you're here today. And, you know, my friend L.A. here, you know, he just, you know, having this platform, you know, he's done this for 9 years. So I'm really excited to be able to be here and listen and, you know, get these connections. And
now, Chris, tell him what you do, though.
I'm the founder of HOPE. Housing Our People Everywhere is the name of the 501c3. And we have a solution to clean up and recover and rebuild every natural disaster and create a sustainable way of life doing it, building a home that doesn't burn, don't absorb water, stronger, termite-free, mold-resistant, seismic, recyclable, build it without a dumpster, build it cheaper than wood, and get a 60% discount on insurance versus a wooden home. But I want to teach our children that they are the solution to every adult's problem. And 3 Novembers ago, I had a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old come over and build a 10-foot-by-10-foot tiny house with a queen-size bedroom in the attic. And they built it in 2.5 hours. But they never touched a saw either. And in July, down in the factory we have in Louisiana, they started a youth program. And the kids came in and they built a frame. They never touched a saw, but they screwed it together, and then they took it out on site, and it was a habitat build. And they already had a house standing next door, and it was built by adults. They showed up to an empty slab and stood all the walls up and put the trusses on it and outbuilt the adults next door. Now, they still hadn't touched a saw, but it's what they saw. They saw that they were the solution to every adult's problem as they're inheriting every one of them. And now they have a choice. Do they continue to come and do this and make a difference and build something that will last 1,000 years or could be recycled 1,000 times and give unity in the community, giving an equal opportunity, but create jobs, create purpose, but stop the despair and get the people off the street and on their feet. In 2011, I built a home out of recycled cars from Hurricane Katrina. I built it in the middle of the woods with cordless screw guns to prove I could do it in any jungle on the planet. And it was deemed the best built home in the city by every building inspector with over 100,000 houses. But it was built by 5 people that never touched the material in their life. And Congress gave an endorsement and hand-delivered it to President Obama. But in that letter, it said that we had created a way to give the homeless homes and the jobless jobs. And it fell upon deaf ears. But I got vandalized, and my machine was destroyed. But it didn't stop me because no one still had told me a reason not to do it. So in 2018, I became a 501c3. And I found out that I could partner with anybody I want. So I decided to partner with every child on earth. And they own this. And they're going to be able to do this because we adults need to be taught by our children. Our children are pure love, and they're not tainted till we teach them. What they see is what they learn. And they're creators every second of the day. All of us are. But what are we creating? You know, I've been listening to what you've been creating. It's amazing, and I'm very thankful to maybe be able to be part of it here in the future and what else we might be able to do. But the machines that we have produce 2 feet of material per second, and that's 120 feet of material a minute. For every minute that I don't have these fired up, we're failing. because they don't ask for lunch, they don't ask for a break, and they never complain. But they do take away people's complaints. They create purpose.
That's very important.
That's key. I mean, all of us have a purpose. We just don't know it. And my purpose is to ignite a fire in your heart that water will never put out and start an inferno that will never burn you. That's my purpose. And everyone else will have their own. But know that you are part of this solution, because what it takes is you. The people need to know who they are. They need to learn that, because they don't know it. I do have a question I ask everyone, and I don't want an answer to anyone. No one has to ever answer this to another person. But it's, who are you when no one's around, when you get to create and make a sound? That's your question. That's your question, whoever's listening. And answer it only to yourself. But then when you make your list and, you know, you're making yourself out to be who you are, make sure you never do anything on that list you say you don't do, because then you need to put on there that you're a liar and you can't even tell yourself the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's me in a nutshell. I've been doing this for 17 years, but it's time for people to realize that it takes unity. That's you and I together is why. You need hope. That's humans on planet Earth. That's everybody. And the palm of your hand is pink. And I don't care what continent you're on, your palm is pink. And if you show me the palm of your hand, I can show you peace on Earth.
Very good. Very good. Very good. Thomas, and, you know, I appreciate you. It sounds really good.
Thank you.
Kermit, are you on Clubhouse?
And what does that mean? Clubhouse?
Clubhouse is an app, an audio app. It's where the ball is and where the ball is going. I met Chris on it. Clubhouse never sleeps. One day I think, and Chris, you can chime in on this, it probably will rival Facebook, and Facebook has like 1 million eyeballs a month. And that, you know, that's a percentage of the planet. But you might want to download the Clubhouse app to your phone. I'll send an invite later today on that. But
okay,
it's,
I appreciate that.
It's a good way to promote your podcast, and you can – it's, in my opinion, it's better than radio used to be. But it's very relevant. And it never sleeps. You got people in all different kinds of languages. But what you do, I think it'll be out there. You don't have to edit it. It's all done live. And I know you're out on the West Coast, so I know you might be kind of tight on time. But just to wrap it up with you, anything that you want to promote on top of your podcast?
What, you know what, we're just, you know what, I didn't realize how intricate, you know, all their machinery is and everything else like that, you know, that we have all these cameras and everything, but I'm happier with, you know, what I'm learning, and I'm in the process right now of learning what can make me more successful with the people that I work with, but we all are in it together. I enjoy it. I mean, I did radio for 10 years. When I was in Portland,
okay.
Before I went to, you know, to everything else. And radio, you got to turn the radio on when the people are on. But now with the podcast, no, whenever time, anytime people have some free time or they're driving, they want to listen to something, they can go and find your podcast and listen to it. And that's what I like about it, as opposed to the radio. When I used to do radio, you better come on at 4 o'clock.
Because you're right. You're absolutely right, because the smartphone is the new transistor radio. So you're absolutely right. And that's why I bought a, what do you call it, Clubhouse. You download that app to your phone, and there's somebody on Clubhouse with, they got discussions on everything that you can name. And when I hear about, matter of fact, when I was listening to you on Butch McAdams' radio show a couple of weeks ago, you're sitting on something that's on the same level, and it probably is above, a notch or two above, what Don Cornelius had with Soul Train. Because basically, nobody's the only thing out there. So you've got a lot of social capital on different, you know, different levels. that can be converted into a seven-figure income. So that can be on a monthly basis.
Well,
I hope you're right.
I hope you're right. But, you know, the reason is for me to tell people, I have my life, you know what, I never thought it would turn out like it has. I mean, because when you grew up in D.C., as people don't know, me, my brother, and my mother, we were homeless for a long time. We lived with relatives. My mother was mentally ill. But here's the thing. Uh-huh. I try to tell people another thing, too, is that she graduated from Miners Teacher College. That's part of Howard University.
Oh,
number
I remember
one in
that.
Class.
Northwest D.C.? I used to drive past. I remember where that was.
Yeah. She graduated number one in her class. And she had an IQ. She had a very high IQ. But she became paranoid schizophrenic when I was like 2 years old. And so we were with her. And then she would move us around. And then we were homeless. And then we were taken away from her and given to a great-grandmother born in 1886. And my great-grandmother couldn't read or write. Listen, couldn't read or write, tell time or nothing. So we were with her, me and my brother, until probably about I was 12 years old. Then my father remarried, and we went to live with him. But, you know, my life is like, to me, like a fairy tale. So when people say, well, gosh, you went to prison for this? I said, listen, I went to prison for helping hundreds of thousands of people. And because maybe our government saw it as a different way, well, I took the polygraph test. I did everything they wanted me to do. I passed it, but no, being on a newspaper saying I'm this and that and that. It didn't bother me as much as people keep thinking, because they were going after some really good people and that went with me to Africa and didn't ask for any money, just worked very hard. But for some reason, they were after me. And I told them, I said, listen, like I told the judge, I said, listen, I should be getting nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, let alone. I said, how many people work overseas in Africa, spend hundreds of thousands of dollars? Well, we don't know that you did that. Well, I said, what do you think those receipts are from? Well, we don't know if they went here. Well, you know what it is? Let's be realistic. You know, when you're black, hey, it's a different world. We go by different laws. And if I was white, I probably would have been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Hundreds of thousands of people we helped. And I never got money from that. I put hundreds of thousands of dollars in helping people. But you know what? One thing, you know, I'm not, you know what? I'm not a religious person, but if you read the Bible, I think it's Matthew 6 or Matthew 7. You know, they always say, give without people knowing you give. Pray without people seeing you pray. You know, because you have a lot of people that pray and they're praying really hard, but they want everybody to see that they're praying really hard. So it's more for their ego than for really praying and trying to help themselves or other people. Then other people that give, they want everybody to see, oh, I'm giving. Well, no, I gave and was quiet with it, you know, because I don't need people to pat me on my back or good job, permit, this and that. I see people in need, I will help them. I mean, I would get, listen, my life was like a miracle. All of a sudden, I told you, never playing basketball in my senior year, go off of the team, don't play a lot. Then the next year, I'm the top 10 freshman in the country. 3 years later, I'm the top 5 player in the country. Come on. From where I grew up, nothing. We had nothing.
Yeah, I'm glad you told that, man, because that was
a story
that you shared, yeah.
Yeah, but how many black people, you know, let's be realistic. A lot of black people grow up with nothing, but you got to succeed. You know, you just can't, okay, I grew up with nothing and have complaints. People don't compare, they don't care if you don't or if you're not successful. You've got to make yourself successful by working. And like I said, I graduated almost an academic All-American first team my junior and senior year. I made academic All-American Hall of Fame. Because my grade point average was like 3.7, 3.8. You know, I'm graduating my last 2 years of American University and overall about a 3.5. But because it took me, coming from the inner city school, it took me a while to really get catch up. And before I go, real quickly, I try to explain to people, inner city schools, now you can make it because you got computers, so you can learn whatever you want to learn. But back then, you know, you had to be in an environment that helped you learn. But I tell, this is a great example. Educationally, inner city and then suburbs. Well, suburbs got good facilities, good teachers, good all everything that you need. Well, then you have the blacks. So when blacks finally get a chance to compete, well, we would want a chance to compete, it's like everybody lines up on a mile run, okay? Black and the white kids. White kids from the suburbs and the black kids from the inner city. And they say, we're going to race a mile. It's going to be four times around the track. Well, when they say go, they say to the black kids, no, you got to hold back for a while. Let the white kids get a chance to go around once or twice. Then you can start running to see if you can catch them. Well, you have a few blacks that are that talented enough to catch up to the white kids and compete. But most of us back then and sometimes now, they can't compete because they're too far behind. The fundamentals aren't there for them. They didn't have what other kids had. And it's just too much work for them to come up. Well, I try to tell kids nowadays, you can make it nowadays. With the computers, with the internet, you can learn. If you want to learn, read. Now, a lot of kids don't like to read. But I'm telling you, if you work hard, everybody's successful. They did something to become successful. Find out what they did and do it. Just like sports. You got to work. Hey, sports are not easy. Education is, but everybody can get straight A's. Everybody can't be a Walter Payton or Michael Jordan, but everybody can be a straight A student if you work. That's the difference. So, you know, it's sad. When I come back to D.C., when I used to come back to D.C. and go back to where I used to live, it hurt me because most of the guys I grew up with did not make it. You know, most of them have passed away, drugs, or in jail or something, and they weren't successful. Let me just say that. And it's sad because they were good kids. Just didn't have the opportunity. They just didn't have the opportunity. Because back then, you couldn't go to college if you didn't get a certain grade on the SAT. If you didn't get over 800 or something. But, you know, the thing is I tell people nowadays, hey, read. You watch TV, you do what you want. But take time out to succeed in reading. You know, when I was in prison, listen to this. They put me in prison for 4 years. I would read 10 hours every day. I would work out, exercise maybe 2 hours every day, but I would read for 10 hours every day. So I even educated myself so much more I didn't realize. So when I get out, when I'm out now, okay, I see the world differently. You know, I realize now that there are powers that be that we don't know. You know, people say the American government or the Russian government. No, they don't run the world. Money runs the world. The big money people run the world. They run the world. They tell the presidents and stuff what to do. I mean, it's so secretive until we become more educated and learn who these people are. You know, we're playing a game and we don't even know the rules of the game. You know, we don't even know the rules of the game because we don't know what the rules are. So, you know, what I try to do is help as many people as I can. I don't care about my personal goals anymore. I don't have any. I mean, I reached everything I ever thought I was going to ever reach. But to help other people become healthy or get education, I used to pay for about 35 kids in Africa to go to school free because school is not free in Africa. 35 kids for over 15 years that I paid for their education. But yet, I didn't have receipts for all of that, but the kids went to school. So when the government came after me, well, we don't see those receipts. Well, I didn't keep receipts for everything. And the clinic, I didn't keep the receipts from the clinic, but the clinic is standing. And if you ask people in Africa who paid for it to be built, they're going to say Washington. But government said, well, we don't know that. You know, they didn't want to know the truth. And that's why they put me in that situation. But you know what? I'm not bitter about it. Because you know what? I know the people that I helped. I feel bad because I could have helped more people if I wasn't incarcerated. But they knew I wasn't guilty. They know that to this day that I wasn't guilty of anything. But, you know, that's life. You know, some say you got bumps in the road, but I think I come back better because of that.
You're in a position now, because quite a number of people listen to this podcast, so you're going to help some people that listen to this podcast on demand, and you're going to put it this way. This interview, I consider it Kermit Washington Part 1 here on It's My House, because I know we'd love to have you back. And, like, I know there's a time difference, and we've kept you at least 2 hours. So, matter of fact, Walt, if you got the last question today, I'm going to let you have the last question today with Mr. Washington.
No, I don't have a question, just a statement. Hey, you just went 1,000 notches up in my book. It's an honor to have spoken to you and to know your story more in depth than I knew it before. I already had respect, but now it's just exceeded even that. Hey, you're one of the ones, and I have a following around here. I talk to a lot of people, and you, like I say, just joined the pedestal that as far as just knowing the
now,
background.
Walt, tell them about your sister now. Tell them about your sister.
My sister and I are both lawyers. We're in Tacoma Park, right around that Coolidge
Tacoma
area.
Tacoma Park.
walking distance from Coolidge, and she does personal injury, and we do some international law. We have a real, really strong network. Please, if you come to D.C., you let me know when. Dinner's on me. I want to just show you what we do and introduce you and just give you more and more support for what you're doing and what you stand for, because your story is, to me, one of the most intriguing ones in the D.C. area that I've grown up with. And like I said, I go back all the way to those grandparents that were born in the 1886s and the 1896s and that old D.C., and I've kind of learned and understood it a lot better as I get older. And what you represent, because, people don't know that Coolidge area and that Roosevelt area and that Wilson area was segregated during the times where my generation couldn't imagine it. Once upon a time, we weren't even allowed over there. So then you all came over there. So you all were kind of like pioneers for that kind of a social and political scene, an educational scene that became. And like I say, I have, just like you do, so many buddies that had so much potential that never got to maximize it, never got to tap into it, and they became unsuccessful stories where had they had some of the resources that were available that they didn't know about or some of the resources that are out there now, they would have become successful. So I think that's the legacy, and if any way I can help you with supporting what you do, you've got us for life. So get my number
I appreciate that. I'll come back on the show, no problem. No problem.
Okay.
I do the podcast, and I just train people in basketball and stuff like that. But the more, the good thing is about my podcast is just that I just was lucky to have so many people in the inner circle that I know. You know, educators, you have athletes, you have people, a lot of people that I know, and they stuck with me even though I went to prison because they knew me. You know, like I said to the, the judges, but what we as minorities are facing is people not believing in us and not wanting us to succeed. And so they'll do anything they can to keep us in our place. But we just can't let them keep us in our place. We got to show them that we can succeed just like they did, and we can even do better than they have done. And so I tell people, you got to work. You got to put the work in, study. Like I tell you, the guys in, I was in prison, I told them, don't be wasting time in here. What are you going to do when you get out? What are you going to do? And the good thing is that what helped me the most is not only my friends, but the education level that I got. And so they want to picture you and picture all of us as really second-class citizens. But we can't let them do that. We're not second-class citizens. We're just like they are. And no more, no less. But we're not – I don't – listen, like I told one person one time, I said, listen, I guarantee you, I worked just as hard as you in college, and I'm sure you did too. You became a lawyer. We can do it. You just got to believe. You have people around you that make you believe you can succeed. Because, these young kids, they all want to be rappers. They want to be this. Listen, ain't but a few guys going to be rapping and making money. And if you make money and you don't know what you're doing with your money, you're not going to have any left. I was listening to Tyson the other day, how he lost $300 million. Well, he didn't lose $300 million because the government probably took $150 million from him, but he had people around him that were no good. You have to have good people around you, you know,
yeah.
help move you in a positive direction or give you a, make you believe that good things can happen. And that's what we need as a group. And we need great leaders. We don't have – tell me, let me, before you guys go, before I got to go too, who do you consider a black leader right now for us, our black leader? For the black people in America,
I'm extreme. I look at entrepreneurs that from like the Black Enterprise, from that you know that top 100. I look at entrepreneurs. That's just me.
Well, I went to Morehouse undergrad. We had some revolutionaries and people that kind of introduced us to the struggle. And most of my leaders, I consider. The elders who are like on their last leg and the ancestors that are gone, and I kind of use them. I'm right now. I don't see anybody currently in present that, and I try to explain that to the kids. I said you cannot compare this person to that person. I'm not doing the old against the young. I don't do Willie Lynch. I said, but most of the concepts of things we need. I mean, the people who are talking to me, the positive advocacies, the Pan-Africanisms. I said they're talking, but it's been said before. They're just putting a different spin on it. So the knowledge and the direction is already out there. And like you say, it's at the tip of your fingers on your cell phone. It's a library. You're a walking library. You have it in your hand, and you're Facebooking somebody about, you know, where the go-go is tonight. And so your priorities just need to change because you're misusing, you know, one of the greatest educational tools in the history of. So, yeah, as far as that goes, you all are the leaders. But the story that you have, Glenn Harris is a good friend of mine, and I've seen you on his show, and he speaks so highly of you. And like I say, there's so many different examples from that old Washington, D.C., those people that took nothing and turned it into something, and now we let gentrification take those $600,000 houses that our grandparents once upon a time built, struggled, and sweated for. And I saw them, so they're my favorite generation. Those ones that were born in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and I got to witness, and they looked out for me and made me a kid that could go to the suburbs without the struggle and get to see that side of Maryland, my side of D.C., the story that I saw. I hope I answered your question who my leaders were. It's the legends of the past.
Yeah, you know what? It's good that you said that because people ask me, who are our black leaders? The whites, unfortunately, sometimes identify our leaders for us, and that's not true. I just tell them it's not.
Yeah.
The white community tell us who our leaders are. We need to know who our leaders are, and opposed to. I mean, it bothers me so much. But you look around, I don't see a visible black leader right now who's willing to go out there on the limb and say, okay. This is what we need to do, because he's going to be criticized. You know, he's going to have black people talking about him. He's going to have white people. You know, it's just like I'll give you a good example: Herschel Walker. I know you know about Herschel Walker. He is the worst candidate in the world to be a politician, but the whites were pushing him. Oh yeah, well you know the Republicans were pushing him. Oh yeah, he's a good. Well, no, they knew they could control him. They knew he was an idiot. You know, I mean, great football player, one of the greatest of all time. But they were pushing him because they wanted to control him, and they wanted to, you know, to win the Senate. They wanted to win the Senate. Or was it the Senate or the House of Congress was he running for? I don't remember which one. But, you know, they want to pick our leaders for us. He's not our leader. You know, and I hate to say it, like Al Sharpton was not our leader. Not my leader. Let me just say that.
No.
You know, don't pick Al Sharpton to represent me, please. Please.
Yeah.
Let him represent himself. He might be a good man. I don't know. But I just didn't want him to be my leader. You know, we need somebody that's willing to go out there and put themselves on the line and really have the good of the people. See, that's the problem. Got to have the good of the people. Don't be, you know, you're not, don't just like, okay, it gets me upset now. Okay, what's this Black Lives Matter? Well, that person, those women who started that, they just pocketed all that money and they're living like king, queens now.
Yes.
Do you know the history of that? You should read about that.
Kermit, did you ever read the original statement, mission statement of Black Lives Matter?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
But
you know
I read
what?
That was it for me. I had no interest in them after that, reading that.
Oh, no, listen, they're living like kings. They're like queens, kings and queens, because people donated money to them. See, first of all, people that don't have money, you know, you got to be, how do you say it, you got to be suspicious of them getting a whole lot of money all of a sudden. All of a sudden, I read about the ladies that started that. They got mansions everywhere, got vacation homes everywhere. And what have they done lately? I mean, what have they done? You know, here's what, I was in prison at this time. But when the Asian Americans were being attacked, that's when Black Lives Matter united with them, saying, we not only care about Black Lives Matter, Asian Lives Matter, everybody's lives matter, but we're going to support them. We're going to march with the Asian Americans to help show support for them being, you know, being abused right now. But nobody says anything. I mean, that would have been a
That's
smart
true.
Move. Would have been a smart
it would
move.
Have been.
So, but, you know, it's just people, you know, I just want to see a leader who cares about the people, who cares, will sacrifice for the people, not trying to make their pockets fuller with money and really care. Let me help these other people. And there are people like that, but they're quiet. They're not the ones that are outspoken because, you know, they'll probably, society will probably try to destroy you. Your own people will probably destroy you. You know,
the nail that sticks out usually gets hit. Well, hey, look, thanks, Karen, for being on. This
you
is just part one. We're going to wrap up for today because we're in overtime. And once again, Kermit, tell us we can listen to your podcast on, view it rather, on YouTube.
And it's called the 20.
Produce them every week or what?
20. Oh, we're going to be more than probably twice a week.
Okay.
But we just have to learn. We were just learning how, you know, all the, you know, all, with the video and all everything else like that. We're learning more and more, and we're getting to be really good. So we'll try to have two guests a week, maybe three guests a week, and we'll do them all. But everything is going to be recorded. There's nothing going to be live, and then we put it on
there.
It's like watching the TV show, okay? But right now you can probably find it on YouTube at 20 and 20, and probably just Haseem Rahman is the only one we have on. But we have them for, you know, we've done three other ones, and they might get those up by today. I don't know. But I'll keep you abreast of everything, and I don't mind coming back on your show. You know, just let me know, okay?
All right. I'll be going to have you back on the regular. On that,
everyone have a
good rest of the day. Go ahead, Walt.
And you got,
no, I have a couple of people I'd love to introduce you to that I think will be excellent personalities for your podcast. So just
let me know when you're coming to D.C.
We're dropping the red carpet for you if you tell us you're around.
I will. Thank you very much. Take care, guys.
Okay. All right. Everyone have a great weekend.
Take care. All right.